My job, my charge for this next 20 minutes or so, is to give you the whirlwind overview of what's happening with data curation in research universities. So I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of that and then make some recommendations for what we think the most logical roles are for the researchers, the universities, and you, the publishers. And then Toby will talk to you about some specific work they're doing at OECD, and hopefully this will all fit together for you. But it's a lot to get through in a short amount of time, and we're between you and cocktails. So, you know, don't feel bad if it kind of flows over, and ask questions later or come and hear us talk about it somewhere else another time. So this, of course, isn't working. All right. Here's the other one. Sorry, there's lots of devices up here. Okay. It's a little washed out, but the first point I want to make is that research data has been an issue for researchers forever. You know, many of you were researchers, and producing huge volumes of data is nothing new. However, in the past 10 to 15 years, it is almost 100% digital, right? Just like everything else you're hearing about. So researchers are struggling right now with what to do with all of this stuff, you know, instead of the volumes of paper they had before. And just to kind of bring this home to you, just the advent of disk storage, right? This is 60 years ago, 5 terabytes, first disk. Now we have Google data centers that have thousands of pizza boxes that carry 2 terabytes apiece, right? So just the ability to store this data is growing exponentially, and that hasn't changed for the last 50 years, so the volume of content that we're dealing with now is astronomical, and that's not an exaggeration, actually. IDC has been doing some research on just how much information is out there, and this paper is a few years old, but the growth rate of digital information was growing at 60% per year, and that number is actually going up. And that's also bearing out in scientific research data. This particular picture just was convenient. This is the Japanese version of GenBank. And you can see the growth rates that they're experiencing just in the past, you know, 5 to 8 years. And again, exponential growth. Look at the right-hand side of that. And that's just one little type of data. So what are we talking about? Now, first, you know, whatever you may think of when you think of data is not the whole picture. There's lots of kinds of data. What we typically think of is observational data, things that come off sensors. That's certainly a huge growth area, but there's also experimental data. And then we also consider things like software that produces models to be data. And we also consider large media collections to be data. It depends on what people are doing with them, of course. So the point here is that some data is easy to reproduce, but a lot of it isn't. If you think about longitudinal studies where you're looking at things like climate change, the data goes back 100 or 200 years, and you can't reproduce the data that was created 200 years ago, right? So with a lot of this data, being able to keep it so that you can mine it over time is absolutely critical to science. So again, another way to look at it is formats. And, you know, again, you may have a good solution for one of the formats the data is produced in, but there are quite a few, right? There's simple stuff like text and numerical data, and then all the way down to things that are specific to a particular instrument, right? Instrument makers believe in lock-in too. So they invent image formats, for example, that will only work with their software that they give you with their instrument. So this is a very difficult problem from an archives and preservation perspective. And one thing I want, a point that I wanted to make, which I think is important for you to take on board, is that data isn't like books or journal articles where there's a discrete thing that you can cite. A lot of times databases are, you know, full of data that really wants to be disaggregated so it can be reused in new studies and things like that. So what it is that you should be archiving and citing and things like that is a huge area of research right now. It's not a solved problem. So what do researchers do with data? It's worth taking a second just to think about this. Yes, of course, they want to analyze their data, process it, visualize it, and so on. That's what ends up in the paper. They also want to be able to share it with their immediate colleagues and sometimes worldwide. They want to review it, so they want to be able to look at how data was produced by another researcher, evaluate the methods. They want to annotate the data. They want to be able to cite it if they're referring to it from their own research. Importantly, they want to be able to reuse it themselves, right? You produced a data set 10 years ago, and now you're doing a follow-on study, and you need to go back and look at that old data. Guess what? That's really hard to do now. And then finally, what we see a lot with e-science is that you want to repurpose the data. You want to take a subset of this data set and combine it with subsets of those data sets to do new research. This is what a lot of the cyber infrastructure is aimed at supporting. So we have a lot of innovation going on, and some of it you're probably very familiar with, like these newfangled hybrid articles that everybody's enamored of. I think they're interesting, very interesting. So you get articles that are a combination of the text and the data and the tools to process that data, all in the same package. And this is being experimented by, I think Elsevier is doing some experiments with this, and people like Phil Born at UCSD, who is the editor of computational biology for PLOS, is working on enhanced PDF. So there's a lot going on in that particular area. Another big growth area right now is linked open data, figuring out how to get data sets into standard formats on the web so that they can be found and then reintegrated much more easily. So that's right now, that's mainly in the life sciences, genomic kinds of data. But it's a very popular concept with a lot of researchers, so I think you're going to see a lot of activity in that area. The last point there, data papers, is what I really want to focus on at the end, so I'll just keep going right now. The issues of curation are many. How do you store multi-petabyte data sets for long periods of time and back them up, make, you know, 5 copies of them? We're talking about ginormous amounts of stuff. Metadata, how do you describe data sets? Not just typical descriptive metadata, like the PI's name, but how it was produced. So the documentation. So metadata and provenance kind of go together. The provenance in this case would be the methods that were used to produce the research data. Identifiers, as I said, lots of issues of how persistent they will be, just like the concerns you have about persistence of DOIs. And then the scalability. If you think about it, people like the Concept Web Alliance folks, I don't know if you've run across them, but their idea is that data really devolves to just a triple, a subject, object, predicate, fact. That is the item of citation, and there will be trillions of them. So what if we had trillions and trillions of DOIs? You know, that kind of scaling gets pretty scary. Preservation, I would just refer you to the slide I showed you with all the different formats that data comes in, each one of which presents huge preservation challenges, so that's a big problem. And then sharing, which I'm going to talk about in more detail. The point of this slide is to scare you away from thinking that you want to get into the data archiving business, okay? Lots of publishers think they want to be in the data archiving business, and believe me, you don't. So data sharing. This is another thing that I find encouraging, really, is that a lot of government agencies are starting to mandate data sharing, right? They are realizing that it's not sufficient to publish a paper about your research. You really need to make that data available to other researchers and make it easy for them to get it so they can verify your results and use the data for their own purposes. The public paid for it. It should be available. So just as an example, the NIH grant proposal guides in the U.S. mandate data sharing within a reasonable amount of time. The NSF has just followed suit. So the latest version of the grant proposal guides they've published require you to provide a data management plan with your grant proposal. And they've listed 5 or 6 criteria that you have to address, including things like what format, what metadata, what policies you'll release it under. I think some of the UK funders have similarly done this, and I imagine they all will within, you know, at least the next 5 years, or at most the next 5 years. Interestingly, too, I'm seeing more going on with the publishers. So publishers are beginning to mandate data deposits at the time of article publication. So the latest was this Journal of Evolutionary Biology, and they were very explicit in their author guidelines about which databases you need to submit to for different kinds of data. And it's not just the things that have big national databases like GenBank, that sometimes they say, well, if there's nowhere else to put it, give it to your institutional library. So this I find very encouraging. And then one of the big concerns I have, which is part of the reason I'm working with the Creative Commons now, is this issue of data interoperability. Because as you know, a lot of data isn't cleanly copyrightable. If it's factual in nature, you can't copyright it, but you can copyright databases. and intellectual labor that you've put into organizing data and interpreting data. So it gets very fuzzy what can and can't be copyrighted with this data stuff. And then some countries, like the UK, have sui generis data rights laws in addition to copyright that you have to deal with, but they're all different from each other, the ones that have it. So interoperability is really, really difficult. I mean, we think the copyright system may be flawed, but at least it's fairly consistent around the world, whereas with data, it's not at all. So international scientific collaborations are starting to run into these problems that some countries have crown copyright and over data, and some have sui generis data rights. And so, you know, just figuring out how to finesse all of that is going to be important to prevent science from just grinding to a halt, not because of technical problems, but because of this legal uncertainty. So one approach, and I think there are other similar approaches to this, is to waive whatever rights you might have. You don't have to say what they were. You just say, I give up. You know, if I had data rights, I'm giving them up. So this kind of a, it's not a license, but this kind of a declaration allows you to share your data in a way that supports interoperability at scale. So this is the solution Creative Commons is promoting, and there are other kinds of initiatives like this that are trying to take the friction away from being able to integrate data. Now, libraries have had data curation programs for quite a long time. They often didn't think of them that way, but we've been storing statistical data, for example, statistical data sets for 30 years or so, geospatial data, you know, data formats that felt like we kind of knew what to do with them for quite a while. And now what we're seeing is data being deposited into our institutional repositories without our even really suggesting that. But the researchers are so desperate in some cases for a place to put their data where it has a persistent ID and somebody looking after it that they're starting to do that. So we have begun to promote this concept of data management and best practices for that. We teach courses in it on campus and really try to support researchers and graduate students who are trying to understand what they need to do without becoming data curators themselves, right? And I think a lot of research universities are struggling with what the right balance is between just taking care of it for the researchers and forcing them to do everything, because they often don't know anything, as I'm sure you're aware, about formats and metadata and things like that. But we don't want to just take it on because we don't really understand what the data is. Only they know that. So there's going to be a new model here for how we work with them to get this stuff. And this applies to both the stuff that our faculty are producing and also the things that they're acquiring to do their research and the things that the libraries are acquiring to support research. So the things we do are provide consultation services in a variety of modes. We work with the National Data Archives when they exist to make sure we're aware of what they're doing and can promote those to our faculty. So an example in the US is ICPSR, which is the Social Science Data Archive. We develop or work with communities to develop metadata standards. So DDI is the one for statistical data sets. We're also starting to work a lot with the ontology communities for how you describe data with RDF ontologies. And then finally, we're helping researchers think about how to manage and preserve their data for long periods of time. So we have this data archive. This one is in robotics, for example. A researcher came to us and said, please, 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 can you take this archive? I had it at a colleague's institution. It was defunded as a project. I need to archive it permanently here. Can you take it? So we worked with them to accept this. It's very complicated data that has to do with running robots around buildings like this to generate 3D models of the building after the fact so that you can kind of do some exploration of computer graphics and things like that. So what we did was define the taxonomy they should use for their metadata, customize the system to store that metadata, develop a workflow, load the data, and add these Creative Commons licenses so they can share them. So now people can cite those data sets, and they know that they'll be persistent as long as we can preserve them. Interestingly, the review of the deposits to that collection is not done by the libraries because we're not really capable of doing it, right? It's robotics data, so we need people from that community to do that peer review before this stuff gets deposited. So, new roles for all of us. This is a nice picture that a UK project developed called UK Data Share, and they started with the past, where this is a researcher storing their data on their laptop or more likely their grad student's laptop who's about to graduate. And we've gotten past that now, so we're, you know, and I'm not talking about things now like high energy physics where they have giant infrastructure that they've developed, right? That kind of data is very well managed. I'm talking about rank and file bench scientists and people generating data who don't have those kinds of solutions, all right? So we're trying to get them from here to here. This is where we are now, where you have a subject repositories in a few places and institutional repositories, so at least they have a place to put it that's a little bit better, where there's quality control over the metadata and identifiers and good stuff like that. But really what we want to do now is push them up a little higher to this area, where there actually are community norms around data sharing and data archiving that we can start to rely on for things like large-scale e-science, right? So we need to get from here to here in the next few years. If that picture was completely invisible to you, it's online at the UK DataShare site. So what are the roles? The researcher's role is to provide the data, you know, get it into some kind of infrastructure where it can be combined with other data. So as an example of that, the pharmaceutical industry, which you wouldn't think would be a leader in this area, has started a project called the SAGE Commons, where they're going to collect molecular data, particularly integrative genomics data, and put it into a common platform that they're developing. And the purpose of the platform is to share the data and allow you to build new data sets from it and under a common legal framework, so there's no uncertainty about what you can and can't do with it. This is particularly important to pharmaceuticals and things like organizations like that. So I encourage you to go and look at the SAGE Commons and what they're up to. I think they're doing some very good thinking about this. On the library's side, as I've already told you, our main role is to help researchers organize and annotate the data so that it can be discovered together with organizations like SAGE, and then archive and preserve that data into the future. You know, and we'll be building new infrastructure to do this, new partnerships, and so on. But that's really the role of a library. And then providing the outreach and support to the researchers so they know what's available to them and they have some help to get the data into the archives in the first place. The publisher's role, I think, is really, really important because this is the piece that's been missing. What researchers want in order to share their data is credit, right? That's the number one thing that they ask for. They don't mind, you know, they don't feel so proprietary about it, but they really want credit for it, and they want it to be recognized as part of their scholarly output, right? So what we think publishers could do that would really help this whole movement go up a few levels is, first of all, start to require authors to deposit their data in appropriate archives, right? Get them to do that. And then publish what we're calling data journals, which is the aggregation of these data papers that I'll describe in just a moment. That would allow you to be responsible for managing the peer review of data, which is important for quality control purposes, and start to provide support for credit for data publishing, which is an evolution of the traditional promotion and tenure system that has to happen in order for researchers to really start to embrace this. So what are data papers? This is going to be hard to read, and mainly that's because it's in a white paper that a colleague of mine at the Science Commons wrote called Recommendations for Independent Scholarly Publication of Datasets. So you can just go and get that if you're interested in it. But basically, the idea is to start producing a second kind of formal publication, which isn't the analysis of the data, it's the provenance of the data, how it was produced, what your methods were, and it's to kind of separate those concerns. Right now, those things are combined into the analysis paper, and it's not enough information for people to really be able to evaluate the data itself. Usually, it's talking about small subsets of the data and things like that. So what we want is somebody to, you know, organize the peer review around data and quality control metrics normatively within different disciplines, create the citable entity, i.e. the data paper, which in turn would cite the data itself, or at least reference it so you could go and get to it, establish cross-linking mechanisms between traditional papers and these new data papers, and then require certain kinds of documentation that will allow the data to become reusable and repurposable in ways that are a bit ad hoc today. Establish a common legal license to these papers and the data underneath them, so we have this interoperability. And then ensure that an archiving strategy is in place. Not do the archiving, But just as you do with many other things, you want to make sure that the data is in an archive and will be preserved and not just sitting on the researcher's hard drive. So those are the aspects, the six things that we think should be part of the publisher's role. And that's pretty much all I wanted to say today. So I can entertain some questions now or after Toby's spoken. That's it. Stunned silence. Okay. Chris?
Thanks. It seems to me, from what I know of this space, it's a very fragmented landscape of different kinds of repositories at the moment.
Yeah.
There are subject repositories, there are institutional repositories, there are national repositories. Do you see that sorting itself out over time, or will it continue to be very fragmented?
It'll probably get worse, right? Because
okay.
those big repositories emerged in fields where there was an economic driver to create them, like physics. What we see now is, I imagine that in the future, individual labs may have a data archive that they run, but it's under some kind of standard process so that you can evaluate whether they're doing a good job or not. So it'll get worse before it gets
okay.
better.
So a follow-up from publisher's point of view, you recommended that we should encourage authors to submit
yeah.
data to repositories. Should we encourage them to submit to a specific repository, and if so, how do we pick one?
That is what the Journal of Evolutionary Biology did, although they did punt in a few cases and say, if there isn't anything else, use your institutional repository. That's a way of guiding people away from the grad student solution. And I think you would help a lot in that.
Yeah.
Any other quick questions? Okay. Toby?